Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to a new series of Wireless on Flirt FM, the radio show all about radio. I'm John Walsh and it's great to be back for a third series of the programme. On the first Monday of every month, we'll bring you news and features about the exciting world of radio. AM, FM, DAB and other formats, community, regional and national broadcasters, podcasting and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the September edition of Wireless, we have a distinctively pirate theme. An exhibition on the history of Irish pirate radio comes to Galway. We hear the history of radio in Limerick, a city that punched above its weight in terms of unlicensed broadcasters. And radio researchers tell us about free radio in Spain and the story of British Asian radio.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
We'll have our Radio Retro feature later in the programme, but first to news from Galway. The travelling exhibition on the history of Irish pirate radio has come to town and is on display at the Westside Library on the Seamus Quirk Road until September the 20th. The exhibition, which is touring Ireland, is curated by historian Eddie Bowen to mark the 30th anniversary of the closure of the pirates in 1988. Every small town in the country had its station, and some were large and successful businesses and seen as a threat by RTE. A loophole in the 1926 legislation had allowed them to flourish, with up to 100 stations on air when the sector was finally regulated in 1989 in order to make way for licensed independent radio. Eddie Bowen spoke to Owen Holland of Flirt FM's newsfeed programme and told him about how the exhibition covers the story of the pirates in Galway.
Flirt newsfeed. Local.
Online with us now is Eddie Bowen, a broadcast historian and the curator of an exhibition on pirate radio which is making its way to Galway over at the Westside Library in the Seamus Cork Road, opening today the 30th of August. Eddie, I suppose first off, it's quite an extensive exhibition. There's a lot of stuff in it, and as curator, what was the sort of path and background to putting this thing together? How long were you working on it, and what kind of people did you end up having to talk to and so on?
Well, the reason it was put together basically is that on the 30th and 31st of December this year, it'll be 30 years since the introduction of the Wireless Telegraphy Act, which closed what was probably a golden era of pirate radio throughout the 70s and 80s. So it was just a way of commemorating, firstly to commemorate that event and to kind of celebrate this golden era of pirate radio, which, you know, led to the creation of the radio industry that is today. And it was also to generate interest to get some of the memorabilia that's out there into what will be a dedicated pirate radio archive, which will not alone celebrate pirate radio's history in Ireland, which dates back to 1916 and the Easter Rising, but through the golden era, and to make sure all that memorabilia is protected and saved for future generations. So there will be a permanent pirate radio archive opening towards the end of this year.
It's a fascinating era because at the time there was pirate radio stations everywhere. Every major town and city had something or other going on, and you know, there was people kind of broadcasting from all kinds of locations. What was the kind of vibe at the time? Was it a gap in the media, or what was the sort of reason for such an upsurge around this era?
We dated back to the early 1970s when pirate radio really began to take off. First of all, it was easier to build transmitters to get yourself onto the air, and a lot more people had knowledge of how to build transmitters. But there was a gap in the market because the younger population, that was an ever-expanding demographic, had nowhere to listen to pop music, bar maybe tuning into Radio Luxembourg or Radio Caroline, if you could get it. RTE, as it was, single channel, and basically dedicated an hour's pop music on a Sunday with Larry Gogan. So the pirates came along and filled the market, or filled a gap in the market for the younger generation. And then in the 80s, when what became known as the super pirates, which would probably include WLS and Atlantic Sound in Galway, they came along through basically a loophole in the 1926 laws, and also an inertia from the government, who in the 1980s, if you remember, we went through a certain amount of successive governments, so new laws were put on the back burner. Plus, they didn't want to alienate a younger population who were now voting for them. So it wasn't until 1988, till a more stable government came in under Charles Haughey, that they brought in the new legislation, which was enacted in 1988. But it filled the market. RTE came along with 2FM, but it still didn't accommodate that younger market who were looking for a more cutting edge bit of music, whereas RTE were trying to cater for everybody.
The one thing about the pirate radio era in Ireland is that it gave us a lot of our bigger broadcasters today, and you know, a lot of names that are household names now cut their teeth in pirate radio. Have any of those guys been floating around the exhibition?
Yeah, we've had a few of them in, especially when we had it opened up in Dublin. It was out in the South Dublin County Library. I've actually been generously donated some archives from some of these broadcasters, one or two don't want to be named, as they're still very popular on television and radio. But like the stuff they've retained from the pirate days, they're handing over to the archive. You have names, like many of the big names still in radio and television, the likes of Brian Dobson, Recent News, Anne Casson, Mark Cagney, Aidan Cooney. They all started in pirate radio, and that's where they cut their teeth and arrived at the bigger broadcasters, already well trained by the pirates.
What were these stations when they existed? What were they? You know, would they be comparable to the studios of today? Were they sheds? Were they attics, or what were they?
Oh God, no! It varied. Some were built in toilets. If you look online, you'll see some of them. They were built in old style mob caravans, where the transmitter was located on the floor of the toilet. Studio was probably in a bedroom filled with egg boxes all around the walls for a bit of soundproofing. And probably the lounge was used as where you'd sit down, and probably there was a bottle of whiskey. There's a great photograph actually going back, way back, especially in connection with Galway, which we'll be showing at the exhibition, when Radio Sarah Connemara, which was the predecessor of Radio na Gaeltachta, Sarah Connemara was on in 1969 and 1970, which was a campaign to try and get an Irish language station. There's a great photograph of them. They're actually in a caravan. And there's a presenter sitting at the mixing desk, and a pair of turntables, old fashioned turntables, and on top of the mixer desk is a pint of Guinness.
Radio historian Eddie Bowen speaking to Owen Holland on Flirt Newsfeed. And the Pirate Radio exhibition will continue at the Westside Library until September the 20th. In related news, a meet-up of pirate radio enthusiasts will be held in the Ballsbridge Hotel in Dublin on Saturday, October the 20th. The event is organised by Brian Green, an old friend of this programme and a radio veteran himself, and the aim is to collect oral history about the pirate era to be broadcast on a special tribute station between Christmas and New Year. And I'm looking forward very much to going along myself. Tickets are free, but you need to book in advance, and more information is available at pirate.ie.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But now to Radio Retro, our monthly feature that dives into the archives to unearth a gem from radio history. In August, the Pirate Radio exhibition was in Limerick, a city that always punched above its weight in terms of unlicensed broadcasters, so this month it makes sense that our archive clip is from Limerick. One of the city's most popular stations was Radio Limni, run by the inimitable John Frawley, known as John the Man. In contrast with many pirates, which played only chart music, Radio Limni stood out because it catered for an older audience, and John the Man presented a popular morning programme in his own unique style. Here's a clip from 1981.
I spell it in memory, and that was very especially for the Somerville Rovers ladies soccer team, under the guidance of Geezer O'Dwyer, Jerry Casey and Johnny Casey. And they wanted the little shirt my mother made for me, Well, I can't find it. I can't find any of my shirts these days. House is up the wall, upset. It's my fault. 15 and a half minutes to 9 o'clock of a Monday morning, the 17th of August, 1981. That's right, he said 100. That makes a change from 100. I'll have to get Pat Moore a radio for his boat. Keep him occupied, because it must be very boring sitting down there in the river. Messing about on the river, nearly 9:15. John, will you get him up, will you? And stop messing. All right, come on, come on, come on, come on, get out of it.
Did you know that Ashley Furniture give a free gift with every purchase of £50 or more?
No,
you didn't. Well, let Noel Woods tell you of this and other fantastic offers, such as extending leaf dining tables, 4 chairs and 2 carvers from £2.95, 1/5 off all 3-piece suites, 3-foot beds from £38, also avail of the 7-day reupholstery service. All this and more at Ashley Furniture, 103 O'Connell Street, Limerick, telephone 40722, beside Ted's Restaurant.
John the Man Frawley, the voice of Radio Limonee, one of Limerick's best-known pirate radio stations. That recording is courtesy of Liam Byrne, and we'll be hearing more from Liam in a moment. And that's our Radio Retro feature for this month, but remember that there's another archival recording of Radio in Limerick on our blog, wirelessflirt.wordpress.com.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Radio Limonee was one of the more eccentric stations broadcasting in Limerick, but the city has had its fair share of pirate radio history stretching back to the 1930s. Like other cities, the pirates took off in Limerick in the 1980s, and the city boasted a range of broadcasters covering Irish and country music, chart music, and the unique style of Radio Limonee. I caught up recently with Liam Byrne, who has been involved in radio in Limerick since the 1980s, and asked him to tell me about the history of the pirates in the city.
Radio Limonee then was probably aimed at the older audience, and then it would have been a case of chatty radio, we'll say, that you felt like somebody was in the corner of the room that you knew. And that was probably the persona. Now, we had hoped to have John Frawley Jr., and he's on holidays this week, so we'll hopefully get him for you in the future. But he would have had a persona that wasn't completely false. And I've had this chat with John. It would have been a persona in terms of, oh yeah, sure, go on, lads. Oh, look outside the window. We'll check the weather. Should we look out the window and walk away from the microphone, or say that he was going to make a cup of tea and he'd actually go and do it. But whether he was actually making it, you'd have heard him stir the thing, stir the cup, yeah, and hear it banging off the cup. Whether he was actually doing that, he was a brilliant showman in terms of that, because he was a shrewd enough businessman and it was a successful business. So you kind of think, he's not quite the, like, there's a Pat Sharp persona going on there, but they were both parts of him. He was a complex character, but he tapped into the older people. He's the one who got mentioned on the Late Late Show in terms of Billy Connolly and Gabo having a chat with debt notices and so on. So yeah. So
he had death notices, and he had, I believe, messages to the kids going to school in the morning, and all sorts of unusual stuff that we would consider very different today for radio stations that are around now.
Very much so. Now, you have, we'll say, stuff like 4FM now, we'll say, which PJ Gallagher might have a catchphrase for a certain group of people or stuff like that, but that was right across the board. We'd say you had the dressing ground brigade. He would have, we'd say, done the mam and dad's jobs of, get up, get up, get up, it's dad. But, like, you're going to be late, do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that was, it definitely much, really, really spoke to people. It would have been the parents that were on, even back then. I know nowadays kids would be kind of roll their eyes a lot sooner, it feels like. But if even then, you'd have kind of gone, oh, cheers, what'd she listen to? But it was part of the day. It was that part of the day. It was part of the routine in the morning. Then, we'd say, he'd be reading news reports directly from the newspaper. He would probably say on air, it's kind of, well, I was coming in here and I was talking to so-and-so, so he'd have the gossip news, and he'd say, but they didn't have much else to say, so I tell you, we'll go down, we'll put on Tommy Drennan now and we'll play this for you, and then I'll go down and get the paper and see if anything else happened. Do you know, it was that kind of conversational And it worked. Whether it was 100% him, it wasn't, because he was a lot more shrewd than the character he played.
He was making money from this.
It was a bit of both. I've spoken to John about it, and hopefully he'll give you more. But he was a shrewd businessman who played a character, but he played it so convincingly it had to be part of him as well. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like just a persona.
He was very much the station, wasn't he? Because I remember listening, and he'd be doing the voiceovers on the ads as well, many of them. So it was like the whole thing was based on him, really.
Yeah, the ads were a continuous tape. So it was the look of the draw, like you just hit play. And half the time it was like, I think it was later adopted by some of the early community stations where it would have been the classifieds, where it was the same music bed between all of them. And it was just changing. Now somebody would say, well, you won't know where one ad starts and one finishes, so you have to have your own segment and be sure of what you're paid for. But that's the way it worked. It was just a cassette tape, press play, went through to the end, got rewound to the end. But it was generally the same music behind it. Then he also did a few kind of sing-along things. Part of his character would have been kind of No Look on Her, Happy Butcher, and apologies to anyone's ears listen to my version of it, but that was
the Happy Butcher you're singing.
Noel O'Connor, the Happy Butcher. He'd just sing it out, and next thing, he's got some great deals this week. Him. That's the thing. There was other cases where it felt like he would have done them live, right, and just recorded them while he was doing them, so they were there then for the next day. Okay. That's the whole vibe.
Incredible stuff. So singing ads live on air and reusing them, but was all part of the show. But he was, as you say, he wasn't a fool. He was making money out of this and was very successful.
Yeah, a really complex character. He would have had so many people, would say, that are around, and there's other names that people would have been familiar with, Tom O'Donnell being one of them, who went on as well to work with subsequent stations. But it was the personality, the vibe, it was the whole ethos of the station. And even by virtue of the fact that, how many years later, people are still saying John the Man. Yes, they do know Radio Mini, but they'd nearly know more about John the Man or know the phrase beforehand. And that's a part of that is because he got mentioned on the Late Late Show with Billy Connolly and Gable.
Yeah. So moving on to the 80s then, what were the main stations here? Obviously, Radio Limney got more competition. I think Big L closed down around the middle of the 80s and other stations then emerged.
Yeah, well, Big L would have kind of overlapped the start of the 80s, and they would have been around the corner here just in downstairs in Ellen Street. They had a pretty decent setup. At one stage they were in the I'm trying to think of which of the newspapers it was. One of the local newspapers where they apparently had the third biggest broadcast network in Ireland, because there were 92.1, 98 and 104 then was in the county.
So they were covering city and county.
They were covering city and county. They had the 194 meter medium wave as well. They had that level of a network and the interlinks between those. And I remember the article was basically saying that, yes, when you set up that and you want to invest in it and even go further, I think Richardson wanted to go further with it, but then you had, you could get a knock on the door and lose the whole lot tomorrow. So there was always that fine balance between getting a decent quality. But they had a big network. The network then went on. They moved it to Kilkee one year for the summer, which would have been where lots of people in Limerick went on holidays, and they took over the top floor of the Atlantic Hotel. And there is a photograph somewhere, and it slipped down behind something, but it's where the top floor of the Atlantic Hotel, which is now gone, would have been a half floor, and the rest of it was just a rectangular block. So you had the half floor, and you'd a letter in each window on the top floor.
Spelling out Big L.
Big L on holidays. Yeah. Oh. That's not what was there, but it was Radio Big L. But it was on 96.6, could be wrong on that one, 96.2 or 96.6 in Kilkee, which meant that anyone who came home from Limerick, and I think it was one of the things that possibly rattled Big L a little bit, because the lads who were here kind of, that's a great idea, we'll go down for the summer, we'll broadcast. People who were on their holidays for the summer thought that was great, because they had the signal wouldn't have reached that far into Clare, so they had their favourite radio shows down on the beach over the summer. I think some of the lads were kind of going, that's a great crack, but coming back to the basement in Ellen Street then might not have been the
most. Maybe, was it called Big L too?
It was kind of Big L. It'll be colloquial as to what it was officially. It was Big L 2, and Richardson had said he had plans for Big L 2. So whether that was the test to see would it work over there or not, whether it was officially BAL2, but he had plans at that stage to maybe test the waters in relation to it. But so,
but do you think it might have been the seed, the sowing the seed of its decline in the end?
It seemed to, because we say the, no, this is one of the little bits that's kind of blurred in history in terms of what goes where, and it's one of the reasons why I suppose interviews like this, you'd love to have them from the time as well. But you've got, it went on from there to become, we say, BL dropped off, but Mike Richardson and Francis Jones were running Midwest Radio from Limerick. That then went on to become Radio Clare above in Ennis, Francis and Mike again with a few others. And then, well, that was pretty good, it was short-lived, and then they went to Kerry, so WRKY, Rocky 103, would have been Big L in Kerry. That was pretty big for a while, and it seemed like you were listening to something familiar, just about get it in Limerick on good days. And then, of course, that dropped off into Horizon, and Horizon then from Banna, seemed, that was pretty much the end of it. So WRKY was in Killarney, and Killorglin would have been the last time the Big Elf light shone, for, I suppose. But Horizon was there for a while after that. And then, of course, we were heading into the 86, 87, then, and of course, 88, most of it stopped.
But there were a few other stations of note, maybe City Centre Radio, because that was in a very high-profile location on Parnell Street in the city centre. So very much the late period of the Pirates, when they weren't ashamed of showing themselves anymore and weren't afraid of being shut down.
It would have been the case, because, as I said, there was some of them there in basements. There was other ones that were in top floors. I know, would say some of the lads in Dublin would have stories of transmitters being thrown out windows if they were raided and so on. CCR probably broke that. I know some of the lads, would say, from Radical Knee went there. I know some of the guys who went there, like, who would have been on part-time, who would have been on at weekends, and they'd go up to CCR. And I know that, again, as with all the radio stations, there's a little bit of kind of competition. Everyone loves the same thing. Everyone knows everybody else. And then if somebody, I heard you were on there, but you're not coming back here, type of thing. So some of the lads from Radio Me would have stories about some of them that left to join CCR. But it was appealing. You came up Gerard Griffin Street. It was right on the corner. And because it's a kind of a skewed corner, it's not a it was right in front of you. It was a prime location. And it was, the full glass windows as well. We say that it wasn't this small window keeping an eye out to see. It was there, and it was known. Ed Myers, who'd been well known to a lot of people around Limerick, as I mean, I would say he's the alter ego. We might skip it just for this one. William Leahy, who went on to 2FM. He would have started with CCR. Gerard Sweeney, who's with Clare FM. So it was the first time, I suppose, that it was so visible. Everything else, you'd kind of, if you're driving around, you'd be looking for a transmitter or a mast or seeing where it's stronger. But that was in your face there.
And was that only in the city, or could you get that in the county as well? Were they aiming for bigger than just Limerick City?
They had 97 and 103. So it seemed to be part of, we'll say, the setup, that there was two transmitters once you went on FM. Whether one of them would now be viewed just as a link transmitter to get it up somewhere and then get it out. So they had 97 and 103. The name being City Centre Radio didn't seem like they were too pushed on going beyond that, but whether that was a conscious decision or not is it does seem like a name that'll close you in.
And one more to note from that period, Hits 954. You were mentioning earlier about a rather dramatic moment when they changed their address from O'Connell Street in Limerick. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there was a few. There was Sound Channel was in as well, but you mentioned Hits 954. Hits 954 was at the top floor of 99 O'Connell Street, and it came as a shock to a certain celebrity that the building had been sublet. So as soon as that became aware of it, it was in the papers around Limerick that they had to basically vacate, and pretty quickly, because he wasn't happy to be associated with the pirate station. And they were on one night, and they basically, doing their thing in relation to this Hits 954 from the home of the hits, which was their tagline, and they had 99 O'Connell Street, Limerick. And they said they were going off the air for a few minutes. Right, so what the hell, right? Because back then, they would have probably been the best FM transmitter that Limerick had heard. The best stereo split, the best quality sound, like the most presence. And so, like, we're going off air for a few minutes. And I think a couple of kind of slight round hums and buzzes and whatever. And you're going, what's going on? Next thing, back on. This is Hits 954, broadcasting from the home of the Hits, 5 Cecil Street in Limerick. So basically, in preparation for moving, they had taken everything across the road, whether it was Studio 2 or whether the Bare Essentials or whatever else. But basically, the only thing that was left at the time that this switched off was just the transmitter. Went that across the road into 5 Cecil Street, plugged it in, switched it on, and they were on like that. So it seemed like, as a youngster listens to the radio, it's kind of, they've moved a whole radio station in 5 minutes. They hadn't. But like, as with everything else in radio, it's all about the perception and the what presence you can get across. The other one would have been Sound Channel, I suppose. That would have been the other one that was reasonably big in terms of pop music and so on. That was Darren O'Brien and Stuart Clark, who's with Hot Press, would have been there for a while as well. And then I suppose that would have been from the point of view of ones that I've listened to, but loads of small ones that popped up for a few months. There was LBC and NBC on William Street. Both, I suppose, if the guys who were involved in that, I know Francis Jones actually ended up there for a while, but the guys who would have been involved in that, and Radio Vera, actually was another interesting take from the same stable. But the guys involved in that would have seen them as kind of the best thing ever. They're a part of Limerick, but I wouldn't have too much information on those. The big other big one in Limerick was Galty, which was the kind of country music station.
Okay.
So I think it'd be remiss of me to kind of say, oh, well, here's all the stations. And then, like we say, John Frawley, which may not have been aimed at me at the time, Galty was huge. Really? For an awful lot of people who would be, we say, people who'd go to the Green Hills for jiving and kind of country and Irish music. Galty was really, really big.
Was that a city station as well?
It was, yeah. It was. It was a city station, primarily country music. There was a couple of well-known characters who would have been on it, Mike Gardner, Claire FM, would have been, and a lot of the names, would say, that have gone on it. Now there's newer names, I suppose, but in 88, 89, 90, when the new station started, most of the names were familiar to people from, and I said, Mike would have been on Galty, Country Bob, who's now living in sunnier climes, would have been a big part of that as well. So,
I'll just ask you a more general question maybe, Liam, is why do you think there were so many at that time? I mean, it's a relatively small city now. It was a smaller city then. Was there money to be made by all of these stations, or were many of them kind of hobby broadcasters, or were there serious bucks being made?
I don't think there was any majorly serious bucks being made. I think for all of the stations, and I know you'd have had stories, you wouldn't have had anything remotely like Dublin, where all the guys were being paid and it was all as above board as it could have been. And there was a lot of stuff that was voluntary. But people seemed to love the buzz. And I think it's one of the strange things in relation to, say, the size of the city, Dublin being the biggest, Cork being next, Limerick then fighting it out for Galway for third place, and depending on whether you include the suburbs or not, just about beats it. But yet, when it comes to pirate radio, it seems to be Dublin and Limerick. I suppose it's the interesting one, in even in terms of when the licences came on in Limerick, the original legal station in Limerick was Radio Limerick 1. There was supposed to be another, by virtue of even the name of it. And it never came on stream. That would say you would have had the AM licence awarded. I don't know if any station was ever, if that was ever really feasible. I know they were touted at the time.
There was an AM licence awarded for Limerick, was there?
There was, yeah. There was an AM licence that never took off at all. And I suppose if you look at the stations like Hits 954, we're on 101 with an absolutely fantastic transmitter. 954 was weak. Really, really weak. Like, you'd be lucky to get it just outside the city. Likewise, we say Big L would have been advertising itself as 194. And likewise, we say Radio Knee would have been on medium wave. It's almost like trying to figure out now, if you were setting up a station, would it be FM, would it be DAB, or would it be the internet? Because medium wave was starting to drift out. Like, even Atlantic came back, Atlantic 252, like, was suddenly the resurgence of long wave, which had been pretty much deserted apart from BBC World Service or something. So medium wave, I don't know if it was ever really a runner. It was probably there for talk radio, like, as in you won't need the fidelity, you won't need the quality. But like, even Century came on legally, the 11:43 was really, really weak. And like News Talk, okay, they can broadcast in mono, but they still got FM, even though you'd imagine it would suit medium wave.
So just to finish up then by talking about RLO, Radio Limerick 1, which of course was the licensed station, the first, apparently, licensed station in 1989. There never was another one, but that had a very checkered history itself in terms of its pirate status. It reverted to being a pirate. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
It did, yeah. There was, I suppose, originally, I think it was probably trying to do too much. We'll say, if you looked at the lineup on that between the different types of shows, the talk shows, there was a significant variety across the day. We're saying between classical and country, and we'll say pop music, and they tried to do an awful lot. As we say, the station, we'll say between financials and trying to possibly be too much. Where one of the things you'll find nowadays, people say, well, make sure they switch on the morning and stay on all day. So there's that in shops, so it's more familiar. They tried to do too much, and it wasn't possible for a station to do everything. One station to do everything, it just wasn't possible. They tried a few experiments as well, which were like Ireland's Overnight Network, which was when they went on satellite, that it was actually available in Highland Radio in Donegal and Tip Midwest, among others. Now, I know there was a few others. So they were actually, where a lot of the stations were shutting down overnight and putting on Super Gold or whatever from the UK, they suddenly had an option. So all of that was done from in Raheen. And some of it raised a few hackles between being on satellite and relaying to other stations. There was also a couple of issues in relation to local news, like where there was a bus strike and there was a question mark over whether, like, okay, can we override that because anyone going to the bus station is whatever. So there was a couple of bits of friction in relation to the license. They ended up losing the license. I'm not going to delve into exactly why, but it was kind of, there was almost a couple of yellow cards, whether they added up or there was something more, I don't know. But the the license then was awarded to New 95 FM. And RLO initially moved to 98 FM with a kind of clever advertising thing, kind of Windows 95 is the thing of the past, 98 is the way to go, which was marketing genius at the time. But then it got bogged down as well in, like, being a pirate. Some of the presenters who had been on it had left, obviously, because they were working for a legal station. They wanted to stay working for a legal station. Some of them stayed put. But then you ended up with the scenario where gradually, okay, it couldn't be on 98 FM. And you got into this whole story whereby, we're not actually broadcasting, it's community groups that are rebroadcasting it. And you're going to go, well, what are they rebroadcasting? Oh, we have a satellite signal. Why do you still have that? So it ended up being reported to the UK, as in, here's what they're doing with the satellite, and kind of, who's they? But the license to broadcast on satellite was pulled, so that shut it down.
So they were continuing to broadcast on satellite after they had lost their license to broadcast on FM?
Well, that was the story that was there, that was how the community groups were picking it up relaying it. So that was
And how long did it continue for then, RLO, in pirate form? When did it finally? I think there was a couple of raids.
There was a couple of raids, there was a couple of argumentative RDS displays and so on, because they wanted to keep the license. And some of that's understandable. If you had the license, you wanted to keep it. They had RLO TV as well, and some of that ended up being almost a simulcast of what was going on air. Now, they had some brilliant things. I've heard stories, from Eddie, who's doing the pirate radio archive and so on, that Paul O'Connell was first on RLO TV, so that one was news to me. But there were local matches, there was local discussion, there was a certain amount of it that was pretty good, right? But then that kind of fell by the wayside into being almost a webcam at the time of what was on in studio. And when that webcam then isn't even studio guests, when it's a phone in, like, I know Off the Ball does some of that but there's three or four people. It's still probably not the best TV. Apologies to Off the Ball, but it's, in their case, it's a strong radio show that carries. It's not meant to be the whole TV channel, if you know what I mean. So it ended up being kind of a little bit kind of haphazard and kind of roll your eyes at times. But look, it's all part of the history, and there were so many things tried, like, was it that TV station was the first kind of local TV apart from cable. Westward Cables was able, who were the original multi-channel, where they tried a local TV station that was through the cable network. They had the Irons Overnight Network via the satellite that was broadcast to other parts of the country. So there was lots of innovation on it, whether they kind of stepped outside the remit of their licence and kind of then got their backs up and then got argumentative with the RDS and stuff. So it was a pity to see it, because it was certainly, as I said, one station that was never going to fill the area. Like it was, if you were saying earlier on about Limerick wasn't that big, but in terms of other areas, we'll say where there's one station serving, it might be enough. Do you know what I mean? Whereas when you're big, you have more diversity, more interest and so on. One station couldn't possibly cover everything because somebody was going to switch off at some stage. So they had to aim big. Limerick didn't get the second license. Of course, since now, there's extra stations that are national stations, and you've also got Spin South West based, and LCCR are doing it a little bit to plug a couple of the community gaps as well. So there's now a couple of stations based in Limerick, even though Spin, we'll say, would be for the southwest. But it's like Dublin in some cases as well, where it's kind of, you switch on and you could have two mainstream stations and two alternative stations and hear the same song on all four. So it's interesting time to head. Whether the future would be stuff on FM or whether the future would be stuff like online, it's going to be interesting. But there's a great history, and as you said, like it's from the very first pirate broadcast coming from Limerick way back when, through Capital RLWE, then through the station that would have made an impact, I suppose, growing up. None as big as Nova or anything like that, but they certainly had an impact. And a lot of the voices that are on are from a myriad of different stations. Like, we'd say, Mike Gardner does a country music show on Clare FM, Francis Jones, Blow and Kerry, Declan's still flying it on 95, and other people, when they bump into each other, kind of, oh yeah, I remember that. Good times.
Liam Byrne speaking about the history of pirate radio in Limerick.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
In June, we attended the fascinating summer school on transnational radio broadcasting at the University of Luxembourg, which included visits to the iconic transmitter sites of the giants of European AM radio, Radio Luxembourg and Europe One. The summer school was attended by all sorts of interesting radio people from all around the world, and we're delighted this month to feature interviews with two researchers working on British Asian radio and on free radio in Spain.
So we're walking from the Europe One Aerobain transmitter installation, and I'm joined by Dr. Gloria Kamkar. And Gloria, can you tell us why you're here at the Transnational Radio Conference today?
Sure, John. So hello to everyone, and I'm Gloria. I'm a lecturer in journalism at Bournemouth University, UK, but I'm also originally from India, and I come from a diverse background in terms of radio, newspaper, media, journalism, television. And here today, I'm here at this site and for also this summer school, because it talks about transnational radio history. And my PhD is about British Asian radio. I'm a community radio broadcaster in an Asian and ethnic community radio station in Southampton. So that's why I'm here.
And what did your research on British radio, British Asian radio, involve, and what period were you studying?
My research period is from 1960 until 2004. I chose this period because the year 1960 saw the major influx of migrants from Indian subcontinent because of the industrial labor shortage, and also from the East Africa. I stopped at 2004 because that year we have a community introduction of community radio, the third year of radio broadcasting in England. So that's why it's 1960 until 2004.
And what were your most important findings in terms of the way that radio was serving the Asian community in Britain during that period?
1960 onwards, BBC started catering to Asian migrants living in the major cities in England. And it proved that local Asian migrant community groups started liking those programs for various reasons, because these programs were made to inform the local community, to educate them how to live in this new country, which has totally different lifestyle and totally different culture, educate them in terms of even English language lessons and entertainment, even having Bollywood music shows. So my findings say that BBC local radio encouraged integration in terms of, you know, Asian community migrants, catering to migrants and helping them integrate into the British society. It also encouraged community members to go on air and make programs themselves rather than someone making programs for the community and migrants. So it encouraged access, participation, representation, linguistic expression. And as a result, we now have BBC's Asian radio network. At the same time, we have many independent community radio stations serving solely for Asian migrant communities living in England.
And is the emphasis still, in your view, through radio broadcasting for the Asian community, is the emphasis still on integration? And for instance, the use of English or the learning of English, I know that you said that many of the early programs, there was a lot of English involved. Has it switched now perhaps more to serving various communities in their own original languages, or is the picture more complex?
I think that's a very interesting question, and I also think about it, because 1960s was a different case. You know, first generation came from India, Pakistan, having no or not much or very little educational background and little exposure to English. Now, in 2018, the case is different. You know, we have access to radio stations back home also, and which I can listen to on my smartphone. However, I would say that it is mixed now. Mixed in a sense, in 60s, 70s, radio programs were made in English as well to teach English. But now we need programs in Indian and Asian languages, because for the next generation who is living in England, who is more like a British citizen, they need to be connected, they need to understand, they need to learn and actually hear the languages. And it's the other way around now. And that's why it is still relevant. However, because of the technology now, it's changing. We are on YouTube, we are on, you know, multimedia websites and all. But radio still remains, and community radio is playing an important role. And I must say that localness is still an important factor in British Asian radio.
And you're involved in community radio yourself. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and also how the community radio sector in general is or could be serving the Asian community better in the UK?
Yes, so I volunteer at Southampton's Asian and Ethnic Community Radio Station Unity 101 for the past 10 years now, past 8 years now. And I produce and present a radio show in Hindi, mainly Hindi, which is India's national language. The name of the show is Suhana Safar, which means a beautiful journey. And I cover Bollywood's golden era and play songs, talk about films and movie stars. And it's a nostalgic, you know, program for me as well. When I go in the studio and I feel so refreshed, you know, after 1 week, every Saturday afternoon I go there. And I just love it. I have regular interaction with listeners. We talk a lot about, you know, everything really. And it just makes me feel part of the community, feel at home. And I think, and that's the reason I'm thinking now, because my PhD stops until 2004, the PhD study period. And I'm now thinking how these community radios are serving these Asian migrant communities. And that's my next research proposal, really. But to be honest, I can say that, you know, even before doing the research, I think it is needed. I need to analyze in terms of how and in what format. That is something different that I need to investigate, but definitely community radio stations serving Asian migrant communities in the UK are looking very, you know, promising.
And finally, we're standing here in a field underneath a large long-wave radio transmitter beside the original transmission site of the Europe 1 broadcaster. It's been a very exciting site visit for us today. What have your impressions been, and what have your impressions of the conference been in general?
It's a transmitter site where you feel like, oh, wow, this is the technology. And, you know, whatever we do in studio, if this technology is not there, we won't be able to reach to our listeners. You know, we say radio is a blind medium. We talk, we speak in front of camera, not camera, the microphone. And people somewhere sitting, you know, even my radio station, community radio station, is available online. And I get emails from different countries saying, we are listening to you now. And wow, that's so powerful and magical. And it only happens because of these beautiful transmitters.
And your impressions of the summer school in general?
Oh yeah, summer school is fantastic. Only because there are different participants presenting their research on various topics. But not only that, you know, you get a chance to critically evaluate your own research and look back to it in with different perspectives. You get some valuable comments and feedback, and then you start thinking in a totally different and interesting direction that, oh, I might want to try this and study this, you know, researching this in future or, you know, after this. So I think this is really valuable experience, and not just listening to papers, but exploring Luxembourg City is also an interesting and exciting experience for me.
Gloria Kamker, thank you very much for joining us today on Wireless on Flirt FM from the transmitter site in Germany.
Thank you.
My name is José Emilio Pérez Martínez, and I'm working right now at Sorbonne Université in Paris.
And you're not from France originally, you're from Spain. And what is your background in radio in Spain?
Well, I got my PhD in contemporary history back in the Complutense University in Madrid, and because I've always been a radio historian, and I got my PhD with a thesis on the relationship between women and Spanish public radio during the late years of Franco's dictatorship.
But you weren't speaking about that topic at the International Summer School in Luxembourg. You were speaking about something else. Can you tell us about what your research has brought you here today for?
Yeah, I came to speak about the free radio movement in Spain back in the late 70s, early 80s, which has also been one of my main researching interests in the last decade. So I came here to talk about the transnational features of this movement, because it got actually highly influenced by the previous experiences that happened in France and Italy.
What kind of evidence did you find that showed that the free radio movement in France and Italy influenced what happened in Spain?
Well, when I started my research, like 10 years ago, I was interviewing a lot of people from the old days, and they were all talking about France and Italy as influences. So I tried to find out how they got these influences, because as they were broadcasting in FM, I suppose that they were not able actually to listen to any of these radio stations. So I realized that there were like three ways of contacting with France and Italy. One was international meetings that were held in France, once organized by the Italian and the French radio movement. And apparently a lot of people from Spain went there, and they get in touch with all those people. And right after, they founded, they established Ona Jure, which is one of the first free radios in Spain. And a few months later, we had a big conference about alternative communication in Catalonia. And a lot of people and philosophers of media came to this conference. So that was another way of knowing about France and Italy.
And this was in the 70s.
Yeah, late 70s, 1978. And they also got contact about through the academia and books that were actually being translated from Italian into Spanish. So that's how Radio Alice from Bologna became famous in Spain, because they actually translated Alice el Diablo, which means Alice is the devil, a super famous book. And finally, about the media, because during the 70s and the 80s, we have a lot of alternative press, like libertarian magazines, Marxist magazines, and they were all doing interviews and reports with and about the French and Italian free radios, and also there were news in the mainstream newspapers that they were following how that was happening, and somehow the way they approach this phenomenon actually frame the public debate when the Spanish Free Movement became such a big thing in the 80s.
And why was there such an important free radio movement in Italy and France? Was that in response to, I presume this was a left-wing movement, was it in response to what was happening in politics in both countries during that period?
I think that it's quite related to politics, but it also has to do with the they were both communications were a monopoly of the state, so they were actually fighting back this way of understanding communication, and they were actually highly influenced by the post 68 new left ideas. Yes. And in the case of Italy, for example, Radio Alice was highly linked connected to the Autonomia Operaia movement. So philosophers like Franco Berardi, known as Bifo, was actually a member of the radio station. So yeah, it was really linked to politics, I think.
And obviously the free radio movement began in Spain after the transition to democracy, so it's deeply linked with the political situation in Spain as well and the arrival of democracy after the transition. So can you tell us a little bit about the kind of excitement that there must have been at the time in free radio circles?
Yeah, I think that it is actually highly related with this new circumstances of freedom, like, and especially during the first years, like the late 70s, early 80s, because we didn't really know what was happening yet. So you could actually kind of do whatever you wanted. And that actually was really, really exciting. After 40 years of not being able to say anything, you had this amazing cheap technology that actually allows you to build up a radio station and start to broadcast and say whatever you want to say. I mean, they were highly influenced by social movements as well. And a lot of people that were part of the first radios actually came from the anti-Franco's activism. So you can actually trace this continuum. And I think that it had to be super exciting, like, you know, finally being able to say whatever you want to say. I mean, and they were actually out of the mainstream media. So they were setting up their own agenda through this you know, illegal radios.
But the freedom didn't last for too long because the so-called socialist government introduced a law clamping down on freedom of the airwaves in the 80s. Isn't that right?
In order to be able to broadcast, as happens almost everywhere, you needed a license back in the day. And there was a point in the mid-80s that there were a lot of illegal radio stations that and they were not all free. I mean, we had what we call free radios and what we call in Spain, and this is kind of international debate, pirate radios. So the problem was that pirate radios actually were looking for profits, and free radios didn't want that. So they were actually disturbing legal radio stations. So the socialist government passed that law in order to put some kind of order within the airways, and they actually focus on giving license to this pirate radio, this radio that wanted to become commercial, and they forgot about the free radios, and they even passed this law had a couple of articles that were actually repressing free radios, that you were not able to use handmade equipment anymore, things like that, which actually only affected free radios. So those were quite hard years, late 80s, the 90s. The movement also suffered this, you know, neoliberal madness that was coming across Europe. But thankfully, in the 2000s, the thing improved, and nowadays we are the movement has is in good health and working.
And how many free radios are there in Spain now? Do you know?
We have this kind of a split that in between free and community radio, although we are all doing the same, but don't say that to anyone. I don't really know the exact number, but for example, in Madrid, that is the town I come from, we have this federation of free and community radio, and we are around 14 right now. And we have this national federation, and I think that we are around 40, almost 50 media. So, I mean, we are doing okay. I mean,
yeah, on this program last year, we interviewed the somebody from Contrabanda FM in Barcelona, which was one of many free radio stations there, and it seemed to be a very lively scene in that city. But how are these radios continuing with the legal status being somewhat unclear without a license? Is there repression by the authorities? Are the authorities trying to stop them?
The panorama in Spain has always been tricky. Because it was like, all right, we know that you are illegal, we know that you are there, but we just let you exist. But from time to time, you have this big problem. Like, for example, we have now a radio station in A Coruña, in Galicia, Quack FM, that is actually was facing a fine in between 100,000 and 200,000 euros because of being broadcasting through the FM. I mean, and they've been there for 23 years. Mm-hmm. So why now? I mean, so we have this kind of tricky situation. We are recognizing the last law that was passed about the audiovisual spectrum back in 2010. But and the law say that we deserve frequency licenses, but the government is not giving us any, so it's kind of a tricky situation. We can be there, but from time to time they realize that we are kind of dangerous or something because of freedom of speech, and they come for us.
And you're involved in a station yourself in Madrid, Radio Enlace. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'm actually involved in Radio Almenara.
Yes, you were wearing a T-shirt for Radio Enlace, yes. So.
Yeah, but we are like brothers, you know, because we are like we are both in Northern Madrid, Radio Enlace in Hortaleza and Radio Almenara in La Ventilla, which are traditional working class districts. And, Almenara has been there for like 25 years and is one of the youngest radios in Madrid, so it's kind of an amazing radio station. It's been we've been going through difficult times lately, but I mean somehow we always find a way to keep on fighting. And I'm a little bit sad because like in 3 days we are having our festival. We organize a music festival every summer, and I'm gonna miss this one. It's gonna be the first time since I belong to Almenara that I'm not gonna be there. It's like we have this nice park in our district that is underused, so once per year we actually bring it back to life, and yeah, all the neighbors come and we have 3 days of music and food and fun and live radio on stage. So
that's really the philosophy of free radio, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, free and also community. Like we are working for our districts, and we don't want to be inside the studio all the time. It's quite boring, you know. It's much more better to bring the radio outside and show it to people, and you know, that's quite interesting and quite exciting experience.
Good. And last question is, we're here in the Europe 1 transmitter site in Germany, just 700 metres from France and a short distance from Luxembourg, and we saw this amazing facility today. So what are your impressions of this place? What did you think?
Well, the first thing I thought, it was like, oh my God, I could live here, because it's like a super nice mid-century, early 60s building, which is amazing. And once we got into and so the whole place is like, oh my God, why there is not a museum here? I mean, this is heritage, and it's gonna get lost if they don't do anything about it, and it's related to one of the most important radio stations ever.
Dr. José Emilio Pérez Martínez of Sorbonne University in Paris, who's an activist in Spanish free radio, and before him, Dr. Gloria Kamkar of the University of Southampton, who's an expert on British Asian radio and a presenter on Unity 101. And that brings us to the end of the September edition of Wireless. Join us next month for more radio news and features, including further interviews with radio activists at the Transnational Radio Summer School in Luxembourg. I do hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and facebook.com/wirelessflirt. Until the next time, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.